All statements, views, and opinions are personal and do not represent the United States government, the Department of Defense, or the United States Army. Welcome to the Center for Army Lessons Learned podcast, Insights from the Fight, the podcast dedicated to bringing you lessons learned from exercises, warfighters, and Army fielded forces. I'm your host, Mr. Jeremy Sturmer. I'd like to introduce our guest, Chief Warrant Officer 2, Nathan Shea, winner of the Best Drone Innovation Competition at the 2026 Army Best Drone Warfighter Competition. Thank you for being here today as we discuss your experience training with Unmanned Aircraft Systems, UAS. Before we begin, can you share a brief overview of your military background and experience working with UAS?
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me first off. So I started my career in 2012 with the Pennsylvania Army National Guard. And I joined as a 15 Whiskey. I went AGR, which is Active Guard Reserve, within the Pennsylvania Guard around 2015 timeframe. Then in 2020, I switched over to being a warrant officer. Since then, my entire time, I've basically been a shadow UAS warrant officer since then. And most of my focus has always been within that larger Group 3 platform system size. 2024 timeframe, when the Army decided Group 3 platform like Shadow was no longer needed, and with the intent to switch to a VTOL, we were left without a platform, and I was presented with a quite unique opportunity to go and train with some Ukrainians on Joint Multinational Training Group Ukraine. We were set to train with Ukrainians and train Ukrainians. Knowing how the fight was and what it was looking like, I did kept up with everybody else like that, and so I should probably get spun up on FPVs and first-person view drones and other small systems. So I spent some time learning a lot about how they function, how to build them, how to program them, really to try and prepare myself for that operation. Over there in Germany, I worked heavily with 2CR and 173rd, and we really kind of made a successful rotational thing, as well as 1st Cav was there for a while with us as well. Kind of led me to being in the right place at the right time to learn a lot of unique things that the Army's really shifted its focus into.
Excellent, Chief Shea. Normally, I build these discussions going from the past toward the future, but today I want to start with your most recent experiences. Describe the Army's Best Drone Competition. What were the scenarios that you encountered, and what did it take to compete at that event?
Yeah, absolutely. So I will say this was, you know, the first of its kind hosted by the Army as a whole, right? We've seen a couple offshoots here and there, and, you know, we've seen the gauntlet with the multi-unit pieces and a couple multinational systems out there as well. For this one, it was quite unique. Whole Army to compete between Combo 1, Combo 2, and Combo 3 all coming together in a face-off. And I really think they did a great job with the setup of it, having three different events in there to push it all forward. The FPV racing, you know, it doesn't quite serve the tactical purpose, but it really does provide that engagement into this type of world. And I think it really helps people come in and have a more appreciative understanding of what it takes to operate an FPV system. So that's why I really like the FPV racing portion that they brought in. I also, the tactics lane, EMCO did a great job with bringing that tactics lane into the forefront of all of this, understanding the hunter-killer teams, how they operate, and it really enables anyone who operated or anyone who didn't operate to take some of those lessons learned back to their unit and start moving forward with some additional tactics and TTP development. And then lastly, the innovation piece, which is where we directly competed, right? Or I specifically competed. That innovations lane, it was unexpected during the initial release of the XOR. Reading through that, I can tell you, I immediately lit up when I read the innovations thing. It was super big, in my opinion, to bring that out there and have the Army put forth a platform for all of these units to come forward and bring out what they're working on. It's been a huge piece of the UAS discussion as we've moved forward here. Innovation it seems to be the hot topic for everybody, and rightfully so when we look at all these other things. So having the Army put it into a very open forum like that, it just enabled the sharing of ideas and showing who is working on what and how they're getting after it to meet whatever they see as the needs of the Army. And even just the needs of their own units. When we kind of took that piece, there's the three of us that sat in a room and decided this is absolutely where we want to compete. And we came up with an idea before we can bring it up and brief it to my division warrant, who is CW3 Reed. And we said we wanted to focus specifically on what we view as a large capability gap in the UAS world right now, which is where you got Project Red, right? We wanted to focus on that, to help EOD and as well as assist in the intelligence warfighting function. One of the biggest challenges we faced was the procurement process. The Army's getting significantly better. I definitely see the steps in the correct direction in the procurement process, but I can tell you it is a challenge. We were very fortunate to have the support of our state and divisional leadership going forward with this project, and they really assisted in helping and guiding us through the procurement of everything. Because all this stuff, most of this stuff is commercial off the shelf that you're taking and modifying individual components to fit the needs that you for your projects. That was a big thing. I mean, I can tell you up until the Sunday before I drove down to Huntsville, Alabama, I was still in the office working on that drone. It was a challenge. We were trying to do something very different, and we were trying to bring something that would just have the wow factor for that competition.
Chief Shea, you discussed Project Red. Can you share more about the recovery and exploitation drone that you used during the competition?
It basically is a heavier lift drone system. It's a quote-unquote X8 configuration, so it has 8 motors, 8 9-inch propellers on it, and it can lift. So it's what you would consider as a semi-heavy lift platform for its size. It has a robotic arm on the bottom of it to actually grab the down drones themselves. That is pretty much the overarching basics of how it functions, of what it is. It stems from the idea originally of a drone that EOD can utilize. As the idea developed further, we realized Ukraine receives a lot of intel from downed drones. So why don't we? And that was the big piece of it, right? So we kind of thought of the role of EOD as well as the intelligence warfighting function for this system.
What was the thing that you felt most challenged about? How did you prepare, whether it was leading up to the event, or did you adapt on the spot in order to be able to be successful at the competition?
Again, moving into the competition, we were fighting timelines. I actually went to PME the month prior to the competition and actually took the robotic arm with me to PME to build in my hotel room, coded it in my hotel room. That was a fun piece. That was probably one of the biggest challenges was time. There was not a lot of time. And then the preparation of assisting my other teammates, everything else that they were, because we competed in all three events, right? So helping those guys prepare and competing for the squad tactics lane. We got a ton of snow up here in Pennsylvania. We were getting snowstorms like crazy the whole time. So just trying to help these guys get prepared, kind of help guide them in the best way possible. Then bringing our team together to put it all together at the end was a challenge. We're Compo 2. It's a challenge. My lieutenant is an MDAer who he worked on a big portion of this project. The other guy working on E7, my platoon sergeant, he's a full-time technician, but he's an MDAer as well. We had constraints. We were enabled to be there by our leadership, though, throughout all of this, which was the biggest thing for that. And then when we got down there, the night before, we were doing some checks on the system, just making sure everything was working as it was supposed to. And we ended up having to basically rebuild the brain box in my hotel room in Huntsville because something just wasn't working. We were not getting proper power distribution out of the DC-DC converter, and the arm wasn't functional. I don't know, 8, 9 o'clock at night? And we were rebuilding that brain box in the hotel room just so it was ready to go the next day. That was a huge, huge challenge point that we worked through pretty much on the spot. We brought a ton of tools with us just in case we ended up with that situation, though. We had initially planned that time that night to just give it a once-over check and then run through our pitch again. Because the next day, we had to do that Shark Tank pitch. And instead, the majority of that time was spent rebuilding a system because of a challenge. When we went into the Shark Tank pitch, we spent a good bit of time just watching the rest of the competitors and learning what they were doing, kind of seeing where they were struggling with certain questions. And we kind of wanted to get a feel for, you know, these questions, because I'm pretty sure everyone on that Shark Tank board had a PhD, and I do not have a PhD.
Okay, well, you bring up an interesting point, kind of like to dive into a little bit. When we look at UAS and certainly what we're seeing out of Ukraine, the idea that the soldier themselves are going to have to do things to make adjustments to the systems. When you were a shadow operator, the system did what it was told to do and we didn't really modify it. You don't see that in current operating environments across the world based on the threats. There's a constant modification requirement that's going on. How do you see this competition as helping build understanding for the force that we're not going to be able to rely on a system to solve everything, that we're going to have to be able to adapt those systems to the environments in order to be successful in the future?
So that's a great question, sir. I will say if anyone who is out at that best drone warfighter competition spent any amount of time around the innovation competition or the squad sticks lanes, you would have seen some of the most unique soldier-driven, soldier-born adaptations to systems that you've ever seen in your life. Shadow absolutely was a system that you weren't touching. You were not going to make custom modifications to. You weren't allowed to, right? You would invalidate its AWR. You would break a lot of rules. And that's not the case right now. With the way things are moving forward, we're being enabled to get creative, right? Within safety regulations, of course. But leaders are enabling their soldiers to, probably for the first time seen ever in the military, really get creative and make these systems work for them as they need them to. Just being out there at that competition, I saw some very unique adaptations to assault packs. Just because, you know, how are you carrying five FPV drones around? Soldiers get creative with that in a rapid fashion, what I thought was a good way. And that was something that we're seeing more and more, and I hope we do continue to see it.
As you see this competition continuing and evolving in future years, what scenarios or conditions do you think that UAS teams need to prepare for to be able to go to a competition in the future and be successful in not only beating the environment that they create there, but being innovative and sharing those lessons throughout the force?
I think soldiers need to be prepared to talk about their failures, the struggles they're having within the community. A lot of leaders do not like to discuss failures. There's several of us in the community that go out of our way to try and collect that type of information, though, because that's where we're going to learn, right? So the biggest thing I can say is I hope more people in the UAS community, because I'm not speaking just to UAS, you know, soldiers, I'm speaking to anyone in this realm at this point in time, be prepared to talk to that stuff. Because you're going to help grow the force. If you ran into a challenge that it just stumped you, or you failed at something, like you went to go do a live strike and you failed, why did you fail? What happened? Take that time to be critical of yourselves and understanding that. Truly use the AAR process and help disseminate information. I think that's definitely the best way we're going to move forward for these types of competitions. I think we're going to see these competitions really grow in the future. We may see some competitions that will invite EW to the mix because that's a giant game of chess, right? We see that all the time in the Ukraine, in the Russia-Ukrainian war. So I think it's only a matter of time, and I hope it's only a matter of time before we start bringing electronic warfare systems to the mix and to the fight. And now it's, hey, how are you going to navigate this EW threat? You can add that into a six lane. I don't see why that would be even a challenge point for them to add in the future. So I would definitely say get smart on that type of stuff. Understand what's going to defeat you and how you can defeat it, or build your tactics around that.
You discussed the idea that in our training environments, we need more realism in those environments. Talk specifically about local jamming. I think another discussion that read ISR flying in the lanes to create additional traffic and issues with friendly force identification or other issues. Talk to me about some of the things that you think that we as an Army have to do in order to make our drone environments realistic for both ground forces and for drone operators.
So a lot of this stems from a lot of Ukrainian training. So they will not train at all without some kind of Blue Force and Red Force UAS operational. If they are doing any type of infantry squad tactics, there is a Red Force UAS flying at all times, as well as usually a Blue Force drone training flying at all times. The FPVs are just so prevalent. So they actually have a lane that they have designed where they run infantry folks through this. Basically, they're a dismounted infantry squad. It's a wide open area. They have posts with tires around them, usually meant to mimic trees, but this FPV will fly over, and their whole job is to bound between these posts initially as a squad, and still maintain some resemblance of leadership and command and control of their squad, but also survivability from the soldier side without being single targeted by the FPV or being into a quote unquote kill zone for the FPV. And then they'll throw another one at them and another one at them throughout this whole lane. So when we start looking at things like that, how aggressive their training is, then we need to start adapting that as well. We should not, even at the crawl phase, we can do minimal integration of UAS so that there's a comfort level of experiencing UAS coming at you, right? For us to understand and learn. We should not be doing squad sticks lanes without having a red UAS asset out there. It just doesn't make sense. If you're going to go across an LDA, you need to understand that if you're posted up in an LDA to cover security, now you're in the open, now you're available for sight from red UAS. We can't build that understanding and of where a system can see me or where it can't see me if we don't have those systems flying. We need threat replication systems, and we need to be utilizing those systems in that way. Is when you start using red UAS for the people playing red UAS, right? They do some crazy stuff out in FTC, but we build a lot of tactics and learn a lot of things from what they get to do out there. Let me go develop TTPs with my teams by letting us going and playing red UAS. It's a unique opportunity to fly UAS against the best maneuver force in the world.
Well, you've given me a great chance, Chief Shea, to talk about some of your previous UAS experiences before going to the competition. What were some of the lessons that you came out of that opportunity of working with the Security Assistance Group Ukraine that you have started to incorporate into the way that you approach your UAS activities here within the U.S.?
I can say that prior to my rotation, I did not know SAGU existed. I think I can say that very confidently. I knew of 2CR and the 173rd. Those guys are so well known for what they do over there. And between working with 2CR, 173rd, and the Ukrainians through SAGU, we changed pretty much everything we knew about how to approach UAS training. It was a very unique opportunity to get to see how others tackle these problem sets and build their training out. Within that, we understand now we need to integrate UAS into everything. There is very few mission sets out there that I come across at this point in time where we're not actively trying to integrate UAS into. For a prime example, your unit wants to go do some land navigation. Okay, great. Request the airspace above it, get a UAS up. Understanding how to just move with the UAS system is phenomenal by itself. Putting it on your back, how do you do all that? Just go ahead and do it. But also being able to now move while flying, it's a whole other ballgame. If we're doing something, ground maneuvers, we're doing mounted, dismounted maneuvers of any type, we're probably taking our systems with us in some way, shape, or form, because that is a critical aspect of all of this that we quickly realized. There's a lot of times we see people go out and they do driver's training of some type. Okay, well, it's a prime opportunity to load out your stuff into your JLTV or ISVs or even to your Humvees. Load it out, figure out how things fit, and then how do you maneuver and transition with that? There's a lot of opportunities where things are just left and we focus and isolate on one thing, and instead now it's bring your UAS with you, bring your systems, and just continue to focus on see how things fit together. That was probably the biggest thing we took out of all of that training by far.
And also, when you were with the Joint Multinational Training Group Ukraine, how did you see the SAGU personnel and the U.S. forces that were helping train Ukrainians, how did they incorporate the lessons from Ukrainian soldiers who were experienced in dealing with the threat environment into their training? And how would you recommend that the Army does that as it goes forward?
So I will say we were very, I want to almost say blessed, to have the opportunity to bring in those Ukrainians that had been fighting on the front line to learn from their experiences. We had white cell team members that came through to serve as assistants from Ukraine to help us instruct. And I would say, I think a lot of us learned a lot more from them than we may have originally thought we were going to. We were absolutely teaching them, you know, more standardized things, things that actually may be second nature to some, like map reading. But what we were also taking out of it was how their perspective on the whole fight and some things that may be more antiquated, that the U.S. Army is just, we do it this way because we've done it this way for so long. And I think we're starting to see that change proliferate out between SAGU and NSAGU and your team, sir, on the call side of pushing these topics out and continuously having these harder discussions of, are we doing this for a specific reason, or are we doing it because we've just always done it this way? I think that was a lot of things that were brought to light and that we end up learning from a lot of the Ukrainian forces that we worked with more than anything.
Another unique experience that you had is when you were with the 173rd, you were involved in a successful drone-on-drone defeat. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how it unfolded, and what you take from that event?
Yes, absolutely. I think to really appreciate that perspective is to take a step back to February of last year, 2025, when we were approached by 7ATC and asked to do a live strike event with DevCon partnerships. My team partnered with the 173rd to do that. So it was actually two 173rd E4s that I worked with and helped train up, and then myself to do that first live strike. And that was really what started the fantastic relationship that we have built with the 173rd. And it kind of just continued to lead forward the rest of my time in Germany. And in fact, it still continues today. You know, I talk to them on a daily basis. But in the drone-on-drone defeat for the air-to-air was one of the big culminating events for that. So after we had done that event with DevCom in February of last year, they approached myself and the 173rd just before I left Germany, really asked in our thoughts on doing drone-on-drone events at the UAS summit. And we all sat down, we discussed what it would take to kind of get there, how we could do it. And they were pretty squared away that they wanted to use a less than lethal claymore for this event. And we went out there to Fort Rucker in August. We all came together, because by that point in time I was back in Pennsylvania. And we got out there and just immediately got to work on systems assemblies. We put a weighted inert claymore onto an FPV to really test out that flight, how it's going to feel, understanding what maneuverability I may or may not have with this thing and what the limitations were going to be between our batteries, altitude, stuff like that. And then we just started doing chase runs. Unfortunately, prior to that, we didn't have a lot of chances to test our theoretical TTPs that we had come up with. This was our first real opportunity. We did 2 or 3 days of just dry runs, chasing the fixed wing aircraft that was the target drone. That was piloted by CMU-2 Andrew Poppitz from the 173rd. And I was flying the FPV with the less than lethal claymore on it. It wasn't like a canned event by any means. There were so many factors at play when we start looking at that, between the fixed wing aircraft being significantly faster than our FPV for sheer aerodynamics alone, but also the weather. We were dealing with high wind situation relative to a foam core target drone. That was a huge factor of all this, on top of random rainstorms. So it definitely was not a canned event. And then we went into the initial, hey, we're gonna go, we have two less than lethal claymores, let's do one, and then we'll save the other one for the actual live event. And the first time we went to go do it, I actually had a propeller on my FPV just throw itself away because a motor had failed. Came tumbling out of the sky. I am absolutely one to talk about failures. First time I went to go do it, it was not super successful by any means on a live event. I quickly put a new motor on, repaired that thing, and we put it right back up. We went and did the next engagement, and we were very successful. But it was a very surreal moment, the first time you actually have a success at it, and everyone there was very excited. But I can never say enough nice things about my time working with the 173rd. They were just fantastic to work with every step of the way. Their command team was fantastic, too.
Imagine that you are advising a brigade commander or a division commander at a post, and they're trying to create a truly effective UAS program and capability within their organization. What are the critical investments that you think they need to make in terms of time, personnel, or resources to get that program off the ground?
That is a big question. By far, probably one I'm asked more frequently than not. I will say one of the hardest things about that is people. Getting the right key players in place is probably the hardest thing that every command team will run into in a situation like this. But finding those key players and understanding that talent management will play a massive role, that's the number one thing. And ensuring that whoever you put in charge, whether that be an RLO, real life officer, or a warrant officer, understanding that they should have a high drive for success. And they need to be dedicated to seeing that success come to fruition without breaking the backs of everybody else or stepping on people along the way, because these programs do not easily stand up. For resources, they need to also build their scope, what they're hoping for, understanding their mission set and what they want to see come out of this. If they can understand what they want on the front end or can be asked questions and to develop their commander's intent, you'll have great success at it, because your unit may not want a large FPV force. Even though those look great and they sound cool, they might not fit the mission the best for you. You might need to look more into something like the JTARS mission, where you're looking at logisticians and logistical resupplies. That might fit your mission better. Once you have a person at minimum that you've empowered to make those some decisions and building forward, and now you understand what your mission set really truly needs from a UAS perspective, you can then start really going into it and understanding that FPVs don't operate the same way as, you know, the short range reconnaissance systems or the medium range reconnaissance systems like your Skydios or your C-100s, and that not everybody can fly them. So that's a big piece of that as well. And building that training pipeline goes a far way. If you do need FPVs, enable that person you put in charge of it to reach out to other highly successful units like the 173rd or 2CR or 101st. They are very successful at what they do. Or reach out to me here in Pennsylvania. We get a ton of asks about this stuff, and we're happy to share information. And then going into something like the Skydios for your SRR platform or your MRR platform, your medium range reconnaissance like the C-100, pulling that from the units that have successfully integrated that stuff and have built these squad tactics lanes out, because they likely have already built stick scenarios for their local environment that you could probably adapt for your training, because that's really what you need to end up at. You need to start with building out, you know, your people, where you're going, then you start getting your training platform with that, ultimately ending with what we all know as squad sticks lanes and stuff like that before you, and then you finish it off with the high level integration.
So we've talked a little bit about what higher command can do to enable the UAS platoons. If one of the Army's goals is to make sure that our maneuver forces make first contact with non-human systems, what the goals of the teams or the platoons that are actually manning those systems need to be, what do they need to focus on in terms of those efficiencies they have to build in order to be successful in varying operating environments?
So I would say, like most others will say, reps and sets, right? It's our favorite thing to say, but reps and sets is absolutely critical in this. Battle teaming works very well, but you also need to understand how to not battle team and work cross level. But you need to be super comfortable within your teams. You need to understand that if your FPV operator has 5 FPVs in his or her backpack or whatever that count is, how does he get them out of his backpack? in a rapid fashion. How does your SRR operator, who may be rucking around his system, get that out of his backpack in a very rapid fashion? Because if the goal is for the first contact to be with a non-human system, we need to be able to get that non-human system out rapidly and get it forward rapidly. And that's the only way we're going to do that is through just practice and practice and practice. We need to take notes and, again, be critical of our successes and failures, understanding what we can do better every step of the way, because every time you go fly, it should never just be in the shadow world, they're saying burning holes in the sky. It never should be that. It should be you have a task, you have a purpose, you have something you are actively developing. If you go talk to any type of agency, like any type of state police, something like that, they will go through drills on just drawing their gun in a high stress environment, just multiple reps and sets of that. If you talk to highly skilled teams of shooters and stuff, they teach and they train the basics of things like that in an over and over again situation, so they understand that they will always react appropriately and they know it just becomes second nature for them. So going up to an OP, it's second nature for your guys to, hey, you're gonna do this, you're gonna do that, and you're gonna do this. And everyone just goes and executes immediately because they've trained it over and over again, and we can get those systems forward rapidly.
You've talked about some things that people can do to enable success. As you talk to your peers, what are some of the unintentional roadblocks that either commanders or the Army has to deal with in order to continue to get the growth in the UAS community?
So I think this is probably well known at this point in time, but having systems in hand is absolutely a major roadblock that we're seeing across the force right now. Transformation and contact. TIC units are, generally speaking, set up for success in that world. They have a lot of systems, but there's a lot of units out there that just do not have any systems in hand at this time. And that's, I wouldn't say initially the fault of anyone specifically. It's the United States Army wasn't set up and prepared to make a massive rapid switch like this into this small world. And the industrial base wasn't able to initially handle it. Now, Army Materials Command with Sky Foundry is doing phenomenal work at, you know, understanding that challenge and reaching out to everybody about what they're running into, what challenges they're having, whether it's procurement or funding or, hey, what do you think we need? I think Army Materials Command has reached out to me on a pretty regular basis at this point because they really truly value the feedback that they're getting from these people that are willing to talk to them within the forces. They want to hear these things. They want to know how they can help and how they can help fix the things and help grow that Sky Foundry program into what it needs to be. I mean, we're already seeing a lot of these changes come into play, right? Like the UAS marketplace that'll come, it's gonna be coming online to really help units go through and get systems in hand. I think once we see that come out more and we start seeing that really take hold, we will eliminate a lot of the challenges that we're seeing. That's probably the number one thing I've heard. And then from there, it's a, you know, training is a challenge. We don't have doctrine on this. Fort Rucker has done a phenomenal job at standing up the Advanced Unmanned Lethal Course. And if anyone doesn't know that, that exists, I highly advise them to reach out and look into that. It is a phenomenal course. They are doing fantastic things on there to help try to bridge that training gap that we're seeing right now as well. But the Army's not used to operating like this. We don't have hard set doctrine, and I think a lot of people are still trying to feel out the way of how do we do this. I think the robotics side of all of this is very critical. You know, SOCOM apparently thought it was critical enough to make an entire 3 MOS out of it, the 390 Alpha series. I think they're doing a good job with that execution, and I've had the privilege to see their training before and what their training pipeline looks like. I think they're doing great, and I think they're going to set up themselves for great. But I think we're going to see an extreme oversaturation of people in my community, 150Us. Right now, I haven't seen a .MIL-PFP on this yet, but, you know, which makes sense. But I think there's going to need to be a study done at some point in time on how many systems a 150U is expected to know about. You know, we're UAS warrant officers, but we're expected to be subject matter experts on Group 1 through Group 5 systems. That could be a major problem in the future. You could have a 150U that, if coming from an MFRC, could be down to the squad level. They may end up being a W3 on there that moves to being a W4 at a division or core and now has to manage grade equals. Man, that's a jump. It's crazy that you didn't think about that. That could be a real thing we see in the future here.
What do you think that the Army needs to do to better understand its air operating environment with this proliferation of UAS that we can see coming into the future?
I can tell you that is probably one of the most hot topics in UAS right now, in aviation as a whole, right? Because let's not forget it, the airspace, by all accounts previously, was owned by rotary manned wing systems or just manned systems in general. And now it seems to have relegated to UAS because of the mass saturation of it. I'm not going to lie to you, I don't have a great answer for this one. I think this is a challenge point set that we are just going to have to continue to work through. I've seen some great concepts out there from some extremely intelligent 150 alphas that seem to have worked very well for them, you know, for at least an airspace management perspective. I've seen some that are built off of battlespace phase lines where UAS have the main priority but have the understanding that if an LZ goes hot for a rotary wing system, for a rotary wing, they just got to clear out of that area. I've seen that be very successful. But to build the common operating picture out so commanders from all levels have a better understanding is a massive challenge point right now.
When we look at open source reporting on Ukraine, some of the reports that we put out here at Call, we know that innovation impacts the operating environment. Some examples, Ukrainians are conducting modifications on a single UAS, you know, maybe 500 times over the life of that system. We also see that adaptation that occurs often has a short shelf life between when it is implemented and the enemy being able to change tactics and create a new condition that doesn't favor the use of the systems, right? Like some TTPs only last for a couple days. Some are not going to last more than 20 days before you have to adapt them based on the changing environment. Based on this rapid cycle of adaptation, you know, how do Army leaders empower the soldiers at the tactical edge to innovate with their equipment whilst maintaining the safety that you discussed earlier?
I will say we have to understand the differences in that fight right now. The current structure and the world in which they live is they have an entire country at war. So it basically what you're seeing, in my opinion, and what I've seen, is very similar to how the United States operated for World War I and World War II. There's a reason you can buy a Colt 1911, right? The entire United States switched production into wartime efforts, and that's what they're in. They are absolutely adapting at an immeasurable pace sometimes, but they are structured to do that right now with their entire infrastructure and economy and all of their engineers that exist focused on that wartime effort. If we look at that moving forward, understanding that, you know, soldiers will do absolutely need to adapt systems rapidly and safely, right? The biggest way we can absolutely do that is start refocusing on building smarter soldiers. Ukraine, as I like to say it, builds smart soldiers to operate dumb systems. The Army builds really smart systems right now and has historically built very smart systems. They like to build things down and they write documents the same way to, I believe it's the 8th grade level. They want it to be very user-friendly 100% of the way, but the problem is it may be end user-friendly, but it's not very friendly if you have to start modifying it or adapting it. And this brings us back to our shadow time frame, right? And what that looked like. But if we start and moving forward with that, what does it need to be? We need to build smarter soldiers. I am not an engineer. I do not have a degree in engineering of any type. But what I do have is the drive to learn. I've taught myself how to code in C++. Currently teaching myself through Python coding as well. You have a lot of soldiers out there in the formation that are doing the exact same thing. And they need to be enabled to do that and continue to be enabled to do that. And that's going to be, I think, the biggest thing that is going to set us up for success, because even though we may not be the ones mass producing these adaptations, we might be able to be the ones that make those adaptations that last a day or two. And we need to be able to. And we need to be able to do it safely. I am not a huge proponent, personally, of soldiers doing any type of modifications to any type of munitions. And I think we need to continue to educate our forces on munitions and energetics and how a lot of those regulations and things are written in blood. We absolutely need to be able to go through, and if I need to modify a frequency because it's being jammed, then I need to know how to do that. And that's going to be the biggest thing I think we're going to see moving forward, is stuff like that. And I think the best way we can do it also is to present scenarios where we go to competitions or training environments and soldiers already have to start doing that. Like if you brought an EW system out and put it into a competition, now how do you overcome it?
Excellent. All right, Chief Shea, it's been a great conversation with you today. What advice would you like to give to the force about what we need to do with UAS operations in the future and what people who are interested in UAS operations should do to kind of follow in your footsteps of becoming an innovator within the industry?
Well, sir, I would say the biggest piece of advice that I can say for anyone who's in this realm of UAS is to continue learning. Just because you're a CW2 or W3, it doesn't matter. You are still forever learning, and keep that mentality. If you are a senior leader in this community, specifically to my other fellow warrants out there, please mentor your people. I have been very fortunate in my career to have strong mentors throughout it. My division 150U, CW3, Robert Reed is a fantastic mentor. I have had other great mentors. CW3 Robert Gatta from 1st Cav has probably taught me more in a professional way than I could have ever imagined. And that was just working with him for the few months I have. And building these types of networks has done an absolutely phenomenal piece. And it's one of the biggest things I can say. Build a network. Be willing to talk with people. Be willing to help people. Don't be that person that holds all the information and hoards it. You're not helping anybody or yourself. You need to be the person that wants to go and speak with others and share ideas. Be the person that goes out of your way. It may be sometimes inconvenient, but be the person that goes out of your way to help them and take that time to help them and help yourself, because they're gonna come back at some point in time and just thank you. But what you don't realize is you're gonna need their help at some point in time, and those people are gonna go above and beyond. Like I can say without a doubt, working with the 173rd, specifically CV2 Toppets and CV2 Danny Grumbach, those two have gone above and beyond for me time and time again. Lieutenant Frank Latour, who is now with 75th Rangers, has gone above and beyond to help me time and time again. And even the two CR guys, Mike Brown, who's now up at USARAF, before Mike Brown there, and Captain Ronan Sefton, who's up at USARAF, these guys went above and beyond for me time and time again. I can't even explain it. Like, I still talk to these guys on a regular basis. You never know what your effects are going to be and how long-lasting some of these relationships you build are. Everyone you talk to, just treat it like it's going to be a long-term relationship that you want to build. And you will build a phenomenal network of people that you could just trust and rely on, where if you are stuck or you have a crazy idea, you have the ability to just bounce it off them. I would absolutely say that's probably one of the biggest pieces of advice I can give to these people, give anyone in this community. I think the biggest thing I'd like to discuss is, again, I'm very passionate about the bringing in electronic warfare systems, and I'm hoping that that takes off and the right people hear that and bring those into the forefront of bringing in of these types of competitions or larger scale type training environments, even where it's a giant game of chess between UAS and EW.
For more insights into topics discussed, see Call's Ukraine Sprint Report, First Person Video, tactical and technical lessons from Ukraine, Forging the Future Force, and other products. If you have trouble finding information on our website, use the Request for Information tab and receive direct feedback from an analyst at call. Finally, if you have a best practice to submit or a capability gap that requires a .milpf solution, submit observations directly to call using the Quickfire portal on our website. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on social media. I would like to thank all our call team members, specifically Major Joe Perez and Mr. Alex Brasco, who attended the drone competition. And as always, thanks to Ms. Paige Cox, our producer. Thank you for listening to Call's podcast, Insights from the Fight. We are dedicated to providing you with the insights you need to lead, train, and fight today and in the future. Join us next time for another discussion on lessons learned from the force.